Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, scholars note that the world is waging fewer wars, but that the wars that are waged are more brutal and intractable. How far have we come in the science of making peace? But first, after years of civil war, famine, and cholera outbreaks, the country of Yemen is facing what observers call the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. How did it get to this, and what should be done? Joining us to shed some light on what's going on in Yemen are two experts. Dr. Charles Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland. He served as president of the American Institute for Yemeni Studies, and he's an affiliate scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Professor Schmitz is the co-author of Historical Dictionary of Yemen. Hamoud Sahi also joins us. He is professor and dean of undergraduate studies at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He's also a host of Swana Regional Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles and a commentator for Arabic media.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have both of you with us to talk about this really important issue, particularly what's going on in Yemen, but really Yemen in the context of regional geopolitics and the global geopolitics as well. So thank you both for joining us here. So let's start with the current situation. I've been reading about a magnitude of humanitarian crises that seems to be among the worst in the world. Charles Schmitz, how would you describe what is happening in Yemen?
It is a humanitarian disaster. It has multiple dimensions. There is the war and there's casualties from war. But the larger issue is that the Yemeni economy has been in a tailspin, and it basically has collapsed. So Yemen, through the 2000s, depended upon oil exports to import to pay for its consumer goods, basically. And the oil production has been totally stopped. A little bit has begun again, but the war disrupted it. The central bank has spent all of its foreign currency reserves. And Yemen depends entirely on imports for its food supplies. There are, you know, small amounts of food, but the basic staples of rice and wheat are wholly imported in Yemen. In addition to the fact that there is an air and sea blockade of the Houthi and Saleh forces by the Saudi-backed coalition with the United States and the British. And they inspect the shipments that go in, and these have added a burden. But the real crisis is that the economy has collapsed and people don't have any money. You talk to people in Sana'a, the capital, which is in the Houthi-controlled areas, and there's food in the market. But what you don't see is that the bulk of people don't have the money to pay for it. So university professors, for example, are selling the furniture in their apartments in order to get some income to buy food. That's the real disaster.
I read also that doctors and nurses are dealing with a huge cholera outbreak and haven't been paid in months.
Nobody's been paid. The militias, soldiers get some pay. When either side gets any income, and both have some sources of income, they primarily support the war effort. So they're paying soldiers. So if you're a soldier or running a militia, you're okay. But others don't have their income. Yes, there's a cholera outbreak. It's a result of the collapse of the government and the lack of basic services. So garbage was not being collected. There is no electricity. And the water services have collapsed as well. So the combination of them led to a cholera outbreak, which my understanding is that they're beginning to get a handle on, but it was a real disaster there for a while.
So back up just a bit in terms of the economy and the collapse of the economy. Historically, you said it has been reliant upon oil income to buy basic things like food and pay for the government. So this is all connected to a geopolitical conflict, is it?
The collapse of the economy is not directly related to the fighting. So Yemen had a long-time ruler, Adab al-Salik. He came to power in 1978. He ruled Yemen kind of as a soft authoritarian. In other words, Yemen after 1990, when it unified with the South, the former communist South, they had elections, multi-parties, freer press. His system of sort of patronage worked as long as he had funds to pay for things. In the prior period, in the 80s and 90s, Yemen depended upon worker remittances. So a lot of Yemenis worked in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, and they sent worker remittances back. And then in the 2000s and the beginning of this decade, Yemen depended upon oil exports. And Salih's system broke down. And when the Arab Spring broke out in 2011, he couldn't contain it. He couldn't contain two big issues. One is the Houthi rebellion in the north, and the second was the calls for independence in the south, the former communist south. People there wanted to break away. And those two conflicts put pressure on the regime. He couldn't control it. In the Arab Spring, the inner core of his regime split in two, so some of his top military commanders split and went with the protesters. And then the Gulf states, in particular Saudi Arabia, stepped in, and they had the GCC agreement, which in effect was an agreement with the Yemeni elite, most of the Yemeni elite, in which Saleh would step down from power, but would remain in the country and would not be prosecuted for crimes of his regime. And that transitional government that began from 2012 and was supposed to go to 2014, everybody had great hopes for it. There was a national dialogue conference which all parties of Yemen came together to discuss, and including the southerners and including the Houthi in the north. But basically, that government failed. That government, backed by the Gulf states and by the United States and the international community, it didn't really have a lot of traction on the ground. And the Houthi movement began expanding from the north and came down. And unbeknownst to most, the former president allied with the Houthi and, in essence, took over Sana'a in a coup in early 2015. And the Houthi are friendly with the Iranians. They get some Iranian support, but very little. This is not Iraq or Hezbollah or even relations with the Syrian government. But the fact that the Houthi were friendly with the Iranians, the fact that the Houthi had basically turned over Saudi Arabia's key tribal alliances in the north of Yemen, and the Houthi now control them, this was very threatening to the Saudis. They launched a military campaign, which had a lot to do with internal Saudi politics as well, with the son of the king, who is the commander of the armed forces, and he's positioning himself to be king. He now is crown prince. The Saudis have rarely used their military extensively, and this is a major campaign that they are carrying out. And so this is a new symbolic forward policy for the Saudis that's connected with the crown prince's career. So it's very important to the Saudis. And so the Saudis and the Gulf states, they have a major, the Saudis have always had a major role in Yemen, but this is a particularly important role for them because they are intervening directly militarily.
Hamoud Salih, let's bring you in now. What would you add to this, both in terms of the current situation, the context with which we need to understand it, the sources of both the conflict and the economic collapse? What would you add?
Dr. Smith gave us an excellent overview. A few factors, the numbers a lot of time speak volume. The population, for example, of Yemen today is at around 27 million. Of those, over 18 million are in desperate need for basic necessities. You have more than 10 million who have serious, serious problems. So we're talking about famine, and we're talking about huge malnutrition. Yemen is one of the poorest countries in the world. It is expected that it will run out of water, if my memory doesn't fail me, by 2025. It's a country that has been sort of living in poor conditions for so many decades. It's ruled by alliances, centers around with a tribal leadership until 1996, when Dr. Schmidt talks a lot about this system. But a point that we need to emphasize is that the country was divided between the north and the south. The south was under brand of socialism. The north was morally aligned with the Saudis to a large degree. And then you have the Al-Qaeda that came into a perspective. Another reason one should look at is that the geopolitics of Yemen is very important. Back in 1981, when the Gulf Cooperation was created, Yemen is literally in the Gulf, but the GCC countries, including led by Saudi Arabia, refused to include them for two reasons. One is that it has a different system, and the other one, it was seen as it has a form of government that was not acceptable. It's different. It's somewhat, linking non-monarchical as the other states are. But it was strategic. strategic. It was very strategic for Yemen to have. The Yemenis, because of the vast majority of the population, provide labor to the GCC, and they are mistreated in more ways than one. What added to this crisis, to this recent crisis, is that when you define it as geopolitical, Yemen cannot be looked at outside what's happening in the Arab world. When we look at the Middle East as a system, you have the system is in crisis. The Arab world system has failed, and there is no reason for any hope. And what's happening in Yemen is the same thing that is happening elsewhere in Bahrain and to some degree in Syria. So it is representative of the failure of the Arab system. Second is the competition or the race for the hegemonic control of the Gulf region, namely between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Yemen became the center of a proxy war. The Saudis sees as a way for them to stop or to undermine or to control Yemen in ways to protect their national interests. And the Iranians see this as a way to expect to give them strategic depth in the region. That kind of arms race in the region has impacted Yemen. The fact that today we have no Arab solution to the conflict, not a single interest, despite what's happening in Yemen, in malnutrition, in death, in tragedies unfolding in our race, there is no interest in it. It has in part because of the strategic fight that is between these two regional powers. And lastly, one should not ignore the health issues that are happening with cholera, as you mentioned correctly earlier. So a lot of ways, tragedy is unfolding before our eyes, and we continue to watch it. The Yemenis more and more going through from tragedy to another.
You know, we've been talking about the regional geopolitics, and you mentioned, Hamoud, about the other geopolitics and the potential role that can be played there. It seems that there is very little interest, as you alluded to, from the West. How do you see the West in all of this and its ostensible disinterest?
Well, you know, this is the challenge. What we've seen in the West is that the Middle East is used through two eyes, one through the Israeli politics and the other one, most recently, is through terrorism. Well, Yemen is looked at through the eyes of terrorism. So United States sends drones, kills people there, hurts civilians, and we call them casualties of war, and that's it. So we hear about instances of drones killing or doing some major damage to the country. At that time, we hear about it. So that prism of looking at Yemen in the interest of terrorism continues to prevail. As long as we are containing the threat of terrorism, of Al-Qaeda from expanding to the region, we are okay. And in that matter, you'll see Dr. Schmidt, for example, talks about oil. Well, one of the oil revenues or the oil areas are being controlled these days by the United Arab Emirates, and they are using non-governmental organizations as an umbrella to steal the oil resources and the gas resources from Yemen. The UAE is using Yemeni gas to compensate for what it's losing from its policy towards sanctioning Qatar. So again, here is an instance where what we may call international steal or pillage of a country, but it's also ignored. The idea of getting the West interested in Yemen under the current conditions is difficult to catch. And Yemen is not sexy, as you know, their children seems to be not the same children as the one that showed up on the beaches of European with the Syrians and others. So it's very puzzling. And when you look at the tragedy, more than 60% of the population is severely under major dangers of losing their lives. That's really, it's a puzzle. So strategic goals, the roles that the Saudis play, the roles that the UAE is playing, is very significant. And add to this something that it's very important to look at, the change in leadership in the Gulf countries, in Saudi Arabia, in United Arab Emirates, even to Qatar, is playing a big, big, big role in this. The new leadership, it's a young leadership, educated in the West, having strong connections to the Western world, seems to care less about at resolving conflict peacefully. It's the type of leadership that we have not seen in the past. The older leadership with Sheikh Zayed, for example, in United Arab Emirates, or Abdullah, or even Faisal, if you go back, they were able to work within a system to at least resolve those conflicts in ways that are in a bit human. And this new leadership seems to know how to address issues of the Western press and seems to tack into it for its pure interest. And perhaps that's also play a role in not shedding the lights that was supposed to be on this region, on Yemen specifically, yeah.
Charles Schmidt, what do you say to all of that? Do you see it in the same way?
It's quite a lot. Let's see. The last point about sort of the new military forward policies of the Emirates and the Saudis, they've been buying military equipment for a long time, but they haven't really used it. So this is the first time they've ventured out on their own with the military. I would add to this that the United States and the European Union and the British have been very involved in Yemen. They were big backers of the transitional government, and they've been very concerned about what's going on. The Dutch in particular do a lot of work in Yemen. And there's a lot of relief work that's going on. But there was kind of a shift from the Obama to the Trump administration in the sense that the Obama administration tried to give Iran a place in the Middle East, to give it some sort of role that could be used to mold its behavior in such a way that it had an interest in the regional order. And the Trump administration rejects that. And they basically adopt the Gulf states' view of the conflict, which is that the primary problem, the primary enemy in the Middle East is Iran. And this has played out in Yemen. Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, he was the commander of the Central Command, which is that region. He served under Obama for a while, and then he left. And he was always critical of the failure in his eyes to stop Iranian expansion. And so they see this conflict in that light. But I think it's really important to say that it really doesn't fit that mold. In other words, the Iranians have spent nothing on Yemen, and they only see Yemen important in as much as it bothers the Saudis. This they like, that it has engaged the Saudis, that the Saudis are spending a lot of money on the war, that the Saudis are stuck in intractable conflict. The Iranians like this because it grinds the Saudis down, it grinds their military capabilities down. It was zero investment for the Iranians. This is not Hezbollah. This is not something where they spent a lot of time and effort developing. And the Iranians do not play a big role. Remember that the Houthi are under a naval and air blockade. Nothing gets in there without the UN inspecting it goes in. If the Iranians are getting in there, it's got to be smuggled in. And Yemen is famous for its smuggling. So, yes, this is one of the ways that the Houthi and Salak are staying around. But this is primarily about Saudi Arabia's influence. The relationship between Saudi Arabia and Yemen is very much like the United States and Mexico. The United States fears Mexico. It fears Mexico because of its poverty and its problems, its lack of state capacity spilling into the United States. And the Saudis feel the same about Yemen. They are afraid of Yemen because of its chaos. It's not a place that there's a strong central government. And so Al-Qaeda and other non-state actors, they can use it as a base, and they have used it as a base for attacks on Saudi Arabia. And the Gulf used to rely on Yemeni labor, but they don't like Yemeni labor. They prefer South Asian and Southeast Asian labor because they'll make no claims to citizenship. They'll make no claims to rights, whereas Yemenis who are culturally close and understand, they will make claims. They will say, you know, you're not treating us right. And so they much prefer South Asian labor to Yemeni labor. And so then what do they do with Yemen? Well, what the Saudis and the Gulf would like is to control it in such a way that Yemen is stable enough so that Yemenis stay there and Yemen doesn't implode and, you know, send many poor people across the border. Of course, their intervention has done exactly that. So it seems to have backfired. I wanted to say one more thing. Dr. Hamoud said something very important, and that is that, you know, we don't have Yemeni children washing up on beaches. Yemenis don't get the attention that, say, the Syrians or the Iraqis or others do because Yemenis are trapped. You can't get out. There's no way to get out of Yemen. Syrians can run across the border to Lebanon. They can go to sea. They can cross the Mediterranean, et cetera, et cetera. Iraqis can do this as well. The Yemeni can't. And so because there is no Yemeni component to the refugee crisis in Europe, they don't get as much attention.
You know, it's interesting, the issue about being trapped and then the smuggled Ethiopians and Somalis that were drowned off the coast of Yemen. How do we make sense of all of this?
As incredible as it sounds, Yemen is the poorest Arab country. But Yemen is about on par with the average of sub-Saharan Africa. And Somalis are much worse off. And so the direction of migration is from Somalia to Yemen. And there are Somali refugee camps along the south.
I was wondering, now, they are locked in because they're obviously on the sea on one side. And on the other, is it just they just can't get through the borders?
Right. There are no flights out of Sana'a right now. You could smuggle yourself across the border into Oman. But see, it's got a border with Oman, and the longest border is with Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, is a war zone, and they've cut it off. And then there's no real way, you know, to sort of, I don't know what you do, get on a raft, try and float through the Suez Canal. I don't think it's possible. So there's really no place to go.
And so we were going to talk through now possible ways of making a big difference for these people in Yemen who are clearly going to starve to death and die of disease if some things aren't done. I know there's humanitarian aid coming in, but clearly this can't go on just based on humanitarian aid. What are the, you know, economic, political solutions that need to occur?
There has to be negotiations between the Houthi and Salak. Salak is the former ruler, and he's allied himself with the Houthi. There has to be negotiations between Salak and the Houthi and the Saudis on the one hand, and Houthi and Salak and the Hadi government, which is the Saudi-backed government, which is in Riyadh and in Aden. There has to be negotiations with them. But the difficulty is that the Hadi government has UN Resolution 2216, which calls for the restoration of the Hadi government in Sana'a and the withdrawal of the Houthi from the cities. In essence, it's asking to give Hadi what they couldn't achieve on the battleground. So it's not a very workable solution at this point. What needs to happen is a gradual de-escalation where kind of a third power can emerge. It's not Salak and Houthi, and it's not the Hadi government, but it is a neutral set of powers that can oversee the formation of a new national reconciliation government. And it sounds pie in the sky, but in Yemen it's not. They've done such things. And in fact, in early 2016, there were negotiations in Dahran al-Junubi, which is in Saudi Arabia, where they actually started to do this. And they put together military committees to de-escalate the various conflicts, areas in the conflicts. And it has to be that kind of thing. It's not going to be kind of a, you know, a UN conference and blah, blah, blah. It's going to be a step-by-step, area-by-area de-escalation, military de-escalation, and you start to build trust between the parties. And there has to be a national reconciliation government, which is neither Houthi nor on the Hadi side.
Hamoud Salhi, do you agree?
Those are really some fundamental issues that we have to deal with. But there are a couple other things that might be sort of also important. I think one of the issues, if we look at some of the resolutions that have been passed in the Security Council at this point, there is a path for some kind of reconciliation. There is some kind of path for rewriting the Constitution, for drafting a national government in ways that would be sort of creating a balance, giving some power to the Houthis at the national level. So there has been some discussion, there has been some progress on that. I think the biggest problem is with the Syrian conflict and then the humanitarian issue, which creates more and more and more problems. And of course, with that sorted out, you have the issue of terrorism. A solution to Yemen is closely linked with other issues. Syria is a bit far, but it's also linked to Bahrain, where Iran, despite Dr. Schmidt is very correct when he's saying that their involvement in Yemen are not to the extent that what is being portrayed in the media. But Bahrain is a very important case to look at. Again, you have a Shia population supported by Iran. You still have the Shia in Bahrain struggling, and you have rest that continue to be a problem. So the issue of resolving Yemen could be linked to resolutions at the regional level between the Saudis and the Iranian, and play linking those issues. What we've seen in the late 90s, when Khat Khatami was in power, the Gulf countries, the leaders of that region, saw a detente, or the Iranians and the Saudis and the entire GCC at the time, except for the United Arab Emirates, reached out to the Iranians, Mohammed Said Khatami, and the weird relationship that today still exists, particularly those between the Qataris and the Iranians. The point is this, there is a way out also for the Yemenis to, if the main regional powers are able to sort of resolve or come to a consensus on an agreement on how to put their differences aside. This, of course, is linked to Syria and linked to other issues, but there is also some important issue. There's something to do there. The other thing is that we slowly start to see the importance of this colonial or post-colonial entity, the Arab League, that had some power in the past, albeit, you know, very, very weak. But the fact that bringing leaders to the forum, bringing the Arab leaders to a place where they can negotiate and discuss with each other, that brought some kind of appeasement or resolution to conflicts. The Saudis, for example, were notorious for bribing other leaders to ensure that the conflict don't expand. So you have those kind of approaches were successful. There has been some declaration from the Secretary General of the Arab League pointing out to the need to remind the Arab leaders and the international players or countries of the need to respect the Arab state sovereignty and not to go into this idea of continuously fragmenting the state from another. But the significance of that is that the Arab League could also play a role in this, despite its weakness, in bringing all the parties together. So I guess from one perspective, one could be saying that there are a lot of parts to this resolution, but in the end, what will sort of play a role in this is having a balanced approach between all parties. We've seen, for example, that the Saudis are continuously promoting al-Hadi and presenting him as the president of the country at the expense of other groups. So doing a balance, promoting leaders, Dr. Schmidt talked about other players, is a very, very significant. A deeper issue is the relationship between the North and the South. This is a long conflict, and the plan in the Constitution of dividing the country into several provinces. So there are some ways there to work on, but it takes dedication. It takes also belief in the process, and more than anything else, it takes the Yemenis to be on the same page and agreeing that for the sake to protect their countries, that foreign presence or foreign interference should stay out.
So, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time and your thoughts and your research.
Thank you.
Dr. Charles Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland, and he's an affiliate scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Professor Schmitz is the co-author of Historical Dictionary of Yemen. Hamoud Sahi is professor and dean of undergraduate studies at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He's a commentator for Arabic media.
When we come back, scholars say the world is waging fewer wars. What are we learning about peace and peacemaking? And can we use that to end the brutal wars that are still raging? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. What have we learned from past conflicts and peace processes, and can we use that to end the brutal wars that are still raging? Three experts join us now. Irvin Staub is Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and award-winning author of The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. George Lopez is the Vice President and Director of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the co-editor of Peace and Security, The Next Generation, and Sanctions in the Search for Security. George Lopez was previously Chair and Professor in Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Noren Ripsman is a professor of political science at Concordia University. He is co-author of Globalization in the National Security State and the Challenge of Grand Strategy. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. We have, according to some scholars, seen that the world is engaged in fewer wars today, but we still have a lot of conflict. First of all, is it true that we're getting less violent as a humanity? And if so, what is working and what is not working? George Lopez?
Sure. Thanks so much. I think in terms of the recent data, it's certainly the case that there is less formal war. There's less internal war than there was 15 years ago. But one of the things we find is that when war is still ongoing in places like the Congo or Syria, it's much more intense, brutal, and elongated than we've had before. It's also the case that the degree of fallback after peace agreements try to take hold for 2 or 3 years has increased over time. So we have some good news and we have some bad news. In terms of what's worked, it's very clear that we learn a lot about what makes a solid peace agreement work and all the dynamics that must go into it, maybe as many as 13 or 14 primary factors. Particularly external support, the need for economic development plans, the need for full participation quickly in a national reconciliation process. But it's also the case that with the Syrias and the Congos, there isn't the full international commitment and resources to try to get behind the peace process and empower local people the way it works in some other conflicts.
Irvin Staub.
Well, it's true that in some sense violence has diminished, but at the same time, we have such intense high-level violence in a lot of places that it is almost complacent to talk about decrease of violence. Some of those are what George mentioned. The Congo, he didn't mention the Sudan, where there has been ongoing violence of an intense kind. So it's very problematic, and we must focus on how we can prevent it. I think that for me, somebody who is concerned with how we can go at this from different perspectives, but I'm rooted in psychology, one of the issues is how we can develop more positive attitudes by groups of people towards other groups whom they live with, whom they are in the same society with. And we can't only talk about what it is that we need to accomplish. We also need to talk about how we can do that. And we know from a lot of research that creating joint projects where people work together for shared goals is very important. It's important with kids in schools. It's important with groups in societies. Another really important thing from my perspective is to create positive visions that include everybody in society. Usually when there is violence within a society by one group against another, a destructive vision or ideology develops. What it is that we need to create for our group in order to enhance the well-being or protect the security of our group. And that can be very varied. It can be nationalism. It can even be the vision of social equality, which the Khmer Rouge propagated. But usually, in the cases of such visions, some group is identified as an enemy that stands in the way, and then often it leads to an attempt to destroy that group. So to create positive visions that includes everybody in that society and brings people together so that they can work together for shared goals is extremely important. I also want to mention the issue of healing from past victimization. People, individuals, and groups who are victimized see the world as dangerous, and they very easily lash out when they are threatened again, believing that they need to protect themselves by force, and they become perpetrators in the process. And we have some ideas of how to create healing processes. I also want to mention the issue of justice in these societies. You know, people who have felt victimized or been victimized
usually deeply yearn for acknowledgement of what was done to them and some kind of justice. And this can go on for a long time. You know, in Argentina, after the disappearances, everybody received amnesty. And then 20 years later, there was a new justice process because there was so much unhappiness and unrest in society about the unfinished business of victimization and injustice. So there are a few others that are very important. I will mention just two things finally. One of them is the issue of generating what I call active bystandership. Often leaders don't do what they should do. They also remain passive bystanders in relation to what happens in other societies. So citizens have to become involved and propagate actions by their leaders. And the earlier countries respond to what happens in other countries, the less need there will be for force, for violence, for military action. And finally, in all societies, there is the issue of child rearing. How to raise children so that they become what I call inclusively caring, meaning caring not only about people in their own group, but also about other people, and morally courageous enough that they can take action.
And perhaps then they don't elect leaders that are warmongers in democratic societies. So Irvin Staub has just been laying out the societal level things. Now, Noren Ripson, you've looked at things from the state level. What do we see there?
Well, my research focuses on building peace between regional rivals, a particular kind of rivalry. And what I've found typically is that when regional rivalries resolve themselves, it's not because of societal pressures in the first instance, it's because of states, that is, state pressures, state interests, whether they be alternative threats, more pressing threats internationally, whether it be pressure from great powers, particularly in an era of hegemony where there's one state that's far more powerful than others, the hegemon, or whether it's simply state survival interests, regime survival interests, and the perpetuation of the power positions of the leaders in power. And then ultimately afterwards, when it comes to peacemaking, afterwards, after an agreement is reached, then if the agreement is socialized and society is brought on board, you can have a successful agreement. Whereas when society is not brought on board afterwards, you tend not to have a very successful agreement. Now, on the general question that you posed, I think that right now we are in a moment where the evidence is incontrovertible that warfare, interstate warfare, has declined, particularly in the developed world. The question is whether this represents a trend or whether this is a particular moment in time, whether it's a moment in time because of the presence of a liberal international hegemon in the United States, which has no challengers. I mean, there are other states that may be dissatisfied with the United States and its leadership, but they don't have the capacity at this point to represent significant challengers to it. So whether the question is whether the reason why we're in a moment of greater peace now is because of American hegemony, whether it's because of the spread of liberal values and liberal norms worldwide, whether it's because of globalization and the spread of economic benefits, whether it's because of the destructive capacity of war, as some scholars suggest as well, that makes war at least more difficult to contemplate because of the costs, is unclear at this point. But the question is whether this is simply a moment, and in the event of, say, the rise of great power rivalries again, or, say, in the event of some kind of ecological disaster or even economic crisis beyond what we have right now, where states start calculating in very different terms, perhaps in 20, 30, or 40 years, we might not be in that moment of greater cooperation. So there's really a question about whether this is an enduring trend or whether this is simply a moment in time, like we've had other moments throughout history where conflict was suppressed or reduced for a period of time, but then reemerged.
It's interesting that you bring up the hegemon factor. The last war, interstate war, that turned into a disaster was perpetrated by the hegemon, the U.S., in Iraq. But you also brought up a couple of other interesting points, like the environment, like what's coming with climate change. Will people handle this in a peaceful manner? One other thing that Irvin mentioned was about the creating a peace and reconciliation process. Perhaps we should look at that also. George Lopez, let's go back to you now, and let's look at some of these big questions. One conflict that has not been mentioned that seems to be on the verge of a genocide is the Central African Republic. Let's look at this. Let's look at Syria, the Congo, Sudan, and think in terms of what we know now, what needs to be done to prevent bloodshed.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. And I think when you look at Congo, CAR, and Syria, we're talking about places where all the mechanisms I want to mention actually never got a chance to take hold, partly because of internal anarchy or because of dictatorial rule. And I think one of the things that it's often difficult to convince public audiences and policymakers alike of is the number of cases that turned not into large-scale violence, because what we were able to do was to put in place the preventative or violence mitigating mechanisms that we've learned in the peace-building enterprise over the last two decades. Specifically, for example, if you look at some of the things that were going on during peace processes in Colombia, in Ireland, more in Burma, to a certain extent in Tunisia in the midst of the Arab Spring, what we had was lots of international agencies that do training in everything from security sector reform to police monitoring and retraining to civil society engagement, training people in the values of conflict resolution, the kind of inclusiveness that Urban talked about at every level from schools through civic organizations and the like, training people without very much experience in democracy in their country to the virtues of broad-scale participation and national dialogues. All of these kinds of approaches have been used since the terrible wars in the Balkans in the early 90s taught us that you really need to engage civil society in order to prevent a war of all against all. We've not been able to do that in a Syria or a CAR, but in so many other places we have been. And these are interesting human technologies, human institutions, ways in which we learn that the technologies of peace run the gamut from simple training in mediation and negotiation for community leaders all the way through how you reform the police and the armed forces to be both more inclusive but to understand a very, very different role for themselves in building a new national order. You know, you mentioned Mr. Mandela, of course, is that one of his powers was the ability to call people to an identity and a purpose beyond their self and their existing trained prejudices. And we can do that in a number of ways. And there's so many international and domestic agencies that do that so well.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're talking about what we've learned about preventing and ending violent conflict. In terms of the international hegemon now, Noren Ripsman, I want to go back to you. The U.S. has tried and failed, or maybe hasn't tried hard enough, to bring peace into regions like the Middle East, for example, Israel, Palestine. How vital is it that the hegemon, the United States, play a role there? And if it's not there, what could happen?
Several issues that you raise and that I want to address that were raised before. But first of all, I think it's essential. In order to bring peace between rival societies, states and quasi-state actors have to have key interests that allow them or that persuade them that despite societal hostility, and there's intense societal hostility and antipathy, that they need to take risks and make significant concessions in order to reach an agreement. Now, to begin with, that means that hegemonic engagement is essential or very important. It could happen without it, but it's very important to try to create incentives, both pressure and opportunities for these states in question. But beyond that, the hegemon can't drive the process. The hegemon has to look, and other third-party actors, not simply the hegemon, great powers, international institutions, have to look for opportune moments. They have to look for moments when conflicts appear ripe for resolution. And any efforts they expend at times when conflict isn't ripe for resolution, when there aren't, say, competing threats that are of greater concern to one or both of the parties in question, or when one or both of the parties in question perceives that it has economic interests that may topple the regime, that may threaten the hold on power, and therefore may make an unpopular peace treaty essential for their own purposes, then it may not be an opportune time for outside forces, including the hegemon, to gain leverage over a particular case. One thing I want to address, you know, with regard to this is that I study what I'd like to joke are the easy cases, intense rivalries between regional states. I joke that they're easy because they're not easy, but they're a lot easier than some of the types of cases you've been talking about, where you have either poorly institutionalized states, non-state actors, such as, for example, the Palestinian Authority, or where you have societies with, in the absence of any kind of state institution or top-down hierarchy. And under those circumstances, it becomes a lot more difficult to overcome societal animus. What you need is a strong state in order to be able to reach a decision and carry a decision and then socialize a decision over time. Absent that, societal engagement is great over time, but it's a much longer-term process. And so trying to engage in making peace by engaging society may take, you're talking decades rather than short-term solutions, and a lot of people can lose their lives in the interim, whereas with a state to be able to take a, what may be a very unpopular decision to make a compromise and make concessions can actually do that in a shorter period of time, and there's willingness.
It sounds like you're arguing is that statehood would matter for Palestine. Is that what you're saying?
State building may be very helpful. I think the circumstances were far better earlier in the new millennium because you actually had an entity that wasn't divided on the Palestinian side. And then the idea of building state capacity to be able to reach concessions would have been very appropriate. Now that it's divided, it's not really clear that you'd actually have a unified state that it would be interested in and able to be able to reach a peace agreement. So the moment there may actually have evaporated.
I know Irvin Staub's also been engaged in that region. Irvin?
I have some things to say about a number of things that my colleagues have said. So let me start with some of that and then go to Israel-Palestine. One of these is that the role of external parties is extremely important, and they have to work with internal parties because it's internal parties that are in a position to make a change. But from my perspective, it's not only a hegemon like the U.S. now that can exert very substantial influence. Other countries can also, especially countries that have some kind of a relationship to the people in power in a particular situation. Unfortunately, people who have that kind of a relationship often, because of that relationship, remain silent and they don't exert influence. But if other parties can work with these external parties so that they will exert influence, like, for example, the Arab countries in relation to Israel-Palestine, that can make a tremendous difference. Also, and among other things, the media can be very powerful in creating change. So, for example, in Macedonia, where there was violence between groups there, a number of journalists from different ethnic groups came together, went and interviewed people belonging to these different ethnic groups and wrote stories about their lives, lives that were extremely similar. And then they published these stories in the newspapers of each of the ethnic group. And that kind of thing can humanize the other, show similarities amongst us. Also, talking about external internal collaboration, various NGOs from the outside have prepared ideas for a new constitution in Macedonia, and some of these ideas were included in this new constitution that addressed some of the rights issues and contributed to peace. One other issue, we were talking about interests, and economic interests and various interests and the parties' interests have to lead them to take some kind of action. Unfortunately, ideology often trumps interests. If you look at Israel-Palestine, you could say that creating peace has there been in the interest of both parties for a very long time. But on the Israeli part, for example, the ideology of a greater Israel and the power of a minority that has exerted strong influence in behalf of that ideology was one of the things that has contributed to continuing conflict and violence. And on the Palestinian part, really, it's also an ideology, a vision of how to live life, and that is that there should be a world there, a Middle East there, without Israel. And that has exerted continuing interest. And who could argue with the notion that it has been in the interest of the Palestinians to make peace there? Now, the problem in terms of external bystanders has been that while the U.S. has made efforts at various times to try to promote peace, when it came to really using the power or the influence of the United States, we blinked again and again. So, for example, George Bush the First, when he tried to make loans to Israel contingent that they start building settlements, there was such a pushback that he gave up on it and he didn't engage sufficiently. And I think that there has to be a kind of a determination on the part of external parties who are in a position to exert real influence. If you are a real friend of that country, you are going to use that influence. Now, that means that you are presumptuous. You assume that you know what is better for them. But it is hard to argue that creating peace with the Israelis and Palestinians would have been better for them.
There's, of course, the realities here at home, the role of these interest groups that are attached to ethnic groups that are attached to these countries, the lobbying that occurs.
If I may just add that, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if we here in the United States, especially because we do have such power and potentially such moral authority, we lived in a country where we had presidents who decided, I am going to do the right thing, going to then take the political consequences. Often, if they are successful with the right thing, the political consequences would be beneficial. But very often, they blink. I went when there was bombing by Serbs in Bosnia. I talked to a member of the U.S. National Security Council and said, why doesn't President Clinton do something? And he said, well, the president cannot do anything because people out there in Podunk would not support it. So here is the supposedly most powerful man in the world who, at least one of his associates, said he cannot do anything because it would not be popular. The willingness to take action that is right and could have real benefit that is unpopular would be really wonderful.
George Lopez, let's go back to you now. You've looked at the United Nations and its role. What has been successful and what has been unsuccessful? How would you say it's doing and what has worked? What has not worked?
Well, I think it speaks to the different expertises of those of us you've had on just now, and that I think one could take a look at the UN Security Council and say big power politics operates, and you wind up intervening in certain kinds of ways in Libya and not in Syria, and this is what happens when you deal at the big power level. But I tend to have a lot more confidence in groups like the United Nations Mediation Unit and their various panels of experts who've gone into various conflict zones and analyzed who are the people making money on the gun running, where the porousness of the border is, and who are the civil society actors that might be strengthened and stood up by various agencies in order to create conditions of less violence as soon as possible and create more space for political dialogue. And I think that's the UN that doesn't make the front page headlines, and it's not the one that involves veto power of the big politics, but it really is the way that institutions within the Secretariat and associate agencies really work on the ground. And their ability to bring regional actors together, to bring civil society and militaries together in some kind of national dialogue, often aided by institutions like my own, the U.S. Institute of Peace, I think has really made a difference. In every single case, no. But in many more of the cases, we've had reduced violence than we did a decade ago.
And in terms of some of the programs, does it work?
Well, it depends on what else it's tied to. When you intervene in a conflict to separate warring actors and anarchy has broken out, you're intervening at the worst possible time and with only the military tool left to you. Most of us would prefer the work of whether nation states or international organizations to occur much lower in the conflict cycle when you have enough hate speech and you have enough early outbreaks of violence that you know the direction it's going to go, and it begs for more action sooner at various levels rather than only one action left to you 6 months from now, which is a military intervention. The presence of military troops most especially protect innocent civilians from being slaughtered. They create zones of protection and maybe even a space where political dynamics of diplomacy might work and bring an end to militant forces ruling the ground and create conditions for more nations being now more focused on where we need to go with better political and economic development to create a more stable peace.
Noren Ripsman.
First of all, in response to Irving Staub, I think ideology matters, but the point is that when interests are such that leaders are attuned to the need to resolve a conflict, then ideology may take a back seat. So how do you explain the Saudi peace initiative towards Israel? I explain that in terms of the increasing threat that they perceive from Iran. And as a result, they're more receptive to trying to resolve a lesser conflict in order to deal with a more pressing adversary from their point of view. So ideology, I don't think, is an insuperable obstacle if the conditions are right for some kind of peacemaking. The other thing I would say is that engagement of society can actually be counterproductive at times prior to the resolution of a conflict. If you're dealing with non-democratic states, you may actually have a choice of engaging society, democratization, and spreading liberal cooperative values on one hand or stability on the other. And a lot of the peace resolutions, the peace treaties that I studied, actually are peace treaties with states that are objectionable from a point of view of a Western liberal point of view. But if they got the sense that the international community was trying to go above their heads and democratize or spread liberal values as part of the settlement and not accept the state, you never actually would have gotten, say, an Israeli-Egyptian treaty or an Israeli-Jordanian treaty. And so sometimes we have to choose between, unfortunately, between our values of stability and peace on one hand or liberal values and democratization on another hand.
Of course, the proper approach depends on the exact circumstances. So there has to be an analysis of what is happening and what is the issues and attitudes of the parties involved. All other things equal, I think that the kinds of things that George described that is happening now is of very great importance, because if we act early enough and if we act at those levels, that means that later violence can be prevented. And so early prevention is a significant issue.
What a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much, all three of you, Irving Staub, George Lopez, and Noren Ripsman.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Irving Staub is Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and award-winning author of The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. George Lopez is the Vice President and Director of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the co-editor of Peace and Security, The Next Generation, and Sanctions in the Search for Security. Noren Ripsman is a professor of political science at Concordia University. He is co-author of Globalization in the National Security State and the Challenge of Grand Strategy. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.